For he's always glad when everything's bad, cause then his collections are good, 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 good. His nose knows no pathway of roses, no flowers that bloom in the spring. For it's catch as catch can for the scavenger man. Posterity, where is thy? All right, we're done.
That was so good, man.
Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9. We're here in Las Vegas for a Dev Intersection. I'm here with Steve. How you doing, buddy?
I'm good. How you doing, Seth?
Great. So what are some of the stuff that you work on? Tell us about what you're doing now.
Right now, I'm spending a lot of time on Pluralsight courses and also working with a few clients, mentoring them. I have an emphasis on ASP.NET 5, as well as domain-driven design and just refactoring and teaching teams how to write better software.
So whenever I think of Steve Smith, I think of the calendar.
Oh, yeah?
Tell us about what this calendar is. And I was supposed to get on the Kickstarter. I'm really unhappy that I didn't. Tell us about that, and then tell us how we can get the calendar now.
All right, cool. So a few years ago, I came up with this idea to put together a software craftsmanship calendar back when I had a company called NimblePros. And that company got acquired, and the acquiring company kept doing the calendar. So we had like 4 years worth of them. And then, you know, we didn't do one last year. And so this year we did a Kickstarter to see if anyone was interested in still doing this crazy thing.
Sure.
And the Kickstarter actually, you know, was successful. So we've been working on it all summer. We had some hiccups with our original designer that we had lined up, so we're a little bit behind. We were hoping to get it to the printer October 1st. Looks like it's going to go to the printer around November 1st, like right about now as we're recording this. And then it should be available for sale to other people besides the ones that backed the Kickstarter sometime middle of November.
That's awesome. It's just a really cool calendar of anti-pattern and then a picture to remind you of it.
Right.
Pretty much, right?
Yeah, exactly. Like either best practices and principles or anti-patterns, but the picture is always of the bad thing, right?
So So let's talk about your talks. It's one of the interesting things about development is it feels like we spend a lot of time on here's the new stuff that you should do when you're doing a new application. But the reality of the fact is that most people have applications that they need to improve.
Sure.
What are some things that people can do to make sure that these applications are improved correctly?
Well, I think it's important for us to talk about, like, what is that improvement process called?
Yes.
Like you know, what are we trying to fix? And I typically, in the industry, we talk about technical debt, which is like the sum of all the shortcuts you took in your design. And that you have to kind of work around in your application. And then fixing that is usually done with the process of refactoring.
Right.
And so one of the things that I talked about today in my session was when is the right time to refactor? And for some teams, what they end up doing is they just keep coding away as fast as they can and not spending any time cleaning up their mess until eventually they have to declare like technical debt bankruptcy. And it's either time to rewrite the app or they have to go to the customer and say, hey, we need to take a couple of iterations to just try and fix our code.
Right.
And I don't really like that approach. The story I tell is, you know, if you were going to a restaurant, it's your favorite restaurant, you go there a couple times a month, maybe more, and one day you go there and there's a sign on the door that says, hey, sorry, we're closed. The kitchen got to be such a mess that we're going to have to spend a month just cleaning it and disinfecting it.
You know? It makes you question the food you've eaten up until that point.
Exactly. You're not going to have quite as much confidence in the chef at that restaurant as you had before. And that's got to be what your customers are thinking when you tell them, oh, by the way, we can't give you any new features or fix any bugs. We got to spend a month just cleaning up the mess because we didn't write our code the way we probably should have. So yeah, I promote and prefer that you follow the Boy Scout rule, which is actually one of the calendar images from a few years ago. But basically it says leave your code better than you found it. Meaning, like, every time you check in, just fix it a little bit. Try and make it a little bit better. So that over time, the quality of your code tends to get better.
So it feels like, having said that, you kind of have to know when you're writing, how do you know that this is a problem?
Right.
And then the second part is, like, for example, here's some code that I found. It doesn't feel right. I need to remove, there's some debt there. How do you recognize that it's debt? A technical debt, and then the second part is, how do you fix it properly?
Sure. So like recognizing problems, you kind of get with experience, but you don't have to wait till you've got years and years of experience. You can also learn about it by reading some books or watching some courses. You know, there's a great book called Refactoring that talks about this. It's a little bit dry because it just like goes by like, here's the different ways to refactor this block of code. But a really important part at the beginning of that book is on code smells. And code smells are things where you look at the code and it just doesn't quite smell right. You know, there's something wrong with what it's doing, maybe. sometimes you look at code and you feel like it's you got a smell, but you look at it a little bit closer, you say, no, that's as good as it can be, or it's good enough for what I need right now. But many times it's an indication that you probably ought to think about refactoring this code. I have a course actually on Pluralsight on refactoring fundamentals, and it spends probably half the time just talking about different kinds of code smells and how to recognize them in your code. Another thing you can use, and Visual Studio has some great features for this, are heuristics for your code.
I see.
So you can analyze your project for the static metrics, mm-hmm. like the maintainability index, and my favorite is cyclomatic complexity. And then looking at method by method, you can see which of those methods are least maintainable or have the greatest complexity. And those are always good candidates for refactoring.
So you mentioned cyclomatic complexity and maintainability score index, I think is what you said. Are there any code smells that maybe are not so easily sort of tagged? Oh, this has too many lines of code. Oh, this has a high. What
Certainly.
Are some things that you can look at and say, I could do something there?
Sure. I mean, there's refactorings for things like inline code from a method. Just get rid of the method, take that logic and put it inside this other code. Mm-hmm. And then there's the exact opposite, which is extract method. Take some code that's here, create a method for it, and put it over here. They're both valid refactorings, right? Because sometimes your design is improved by moving the code into a method, and sometimes it's better if the method didn't exist.
Sure.
And a lot of that comes down to tastes of, you know, the team and your tolerance for like how long the method is or how many things it's doing. Sometimes you have to do refactoring for a different reason, like say for performance. In a rare case, it might be that calling out to a method incurs some performance overhead, and it's really tight loop, needs to be as fast as possible. You maybe pull those lines of code in and do it directly inline.
Okay, so we talked about that. Now, the other thing that's interesting about refactoring is there tooling to help us with the refactoring, or are we just, because I feel like one of the, here's an example. You have copy and cut, you copied
copy, paste
and pasted code.
Right.
Definitely a bad thing.
Right. It's one of the anti-patterns in one of the calendars, actually.
How do you fix that in a reliable way?
Another great Visual Studio feature is called Code Clones, mm-hmm. which you're probably familiar with. And in, the premium and ultimate SKUs of Visual Studio 2015, you can run that against your solution, and it'll find blocks of code that are identical or very similar. Like maybe they just vary by the variable names. Mm-hmm. And then you can look at that as an opportunity to eliminate duplication. The don't repeat yourself or dry principle is one of the probably the most important fundamental principles of software development. Mm-hmm. And if you've got code that's scattered in like 20 different methods that's doing the exact same thing, that's something you could probably extract a method from one, then parameterize it, and have all the other ones call into this method. And now if it needs to change, you've got one place to change it.
Right.
Now, your question about other tooling, Visual Studio has a bunch of great tooling support for things like rename, extract method, a bunch of others. There's probably at least half a dozen or more that are there now. Roslyn ships with these analyzers that you
right.
can use now. That's how a lot of that stuff's powered in Visual Studio 2015 today. But you can write your own, and in addition to finding problems with those analyzers, you can have it do the fixes as well. So you can do your own with that. And then commercial vendors, CodeRush and ReSharper are probably the two best known, have a host of refactorings that come with fixes as well that are great.
I think that's awesome. And so I think we're gonna sort of jump to what your next talk is, because I think it will help with some of the refactorings that we need to do. Speaking of testing,
right?
It feels like if you want to make something testable, you have to a priori think that way, because you can write some code that's just not testable.
Sure.
Is there a way to identify the smells and refactor while making the thing testable at the same time?
It's usually two steps,
okay.
right? And testable can be different levels of testability, uh-huh. right? So at the worst testability level would be you can run the thing yourself and look at and observe what it did, and then do your changes, and then run it again and see, yep, it still did the same thing. It's totally manual, mm-hmm. but that's what we do as software developers,
sure,
and we don't have anything else. So you've usually got that as a fallback, if nothing else. Then you can do like characterization tests where you do that exact same step either at the whole application level, or if you're lucky, a smaller unit, like at a class level or unit method level. And you didn't have any tests before, so all you're doing with a characterization test is saying, assert that it does what it does. And then after you're done, you run it again and you verify that it still does what it used to do.
Sure.
And it doesn't mean that what it did was correct, it just means that it hasn't changed. And that's your goal when you're refactoring, is to change the code, make its design better, but not introduce any new behavior.
So what are some things, like, can you give me some patterns of here's some code that's not testable. You do this, and now it becomes testable. Is there any examples?
Sure, sure. So probably the biggest barrier to testability is hidden dependencies. And hidden dependencies are things like you've got a static method call that's talking to a database, or you're newing up a DB context, or you're newing up something that's talking to the file system in the method. And so I've got a blog post and a saying that I use. It's called new is glue. And so anywhere you see in your code base, you're newing up some dependency, you're gluing your code to that implementation. And if you want to test it, it's going to have that implementation there. So you're going to have that file on the file system when you write the test, or that database there. Those kinds of hidden dependencies make code really hard to test. And so there's a principle that I promote called the explicit dependencies principle. And you can search for it online. Basically, it says that your classes should declare all the dependencies they have in its constructor. And ideally, they should be interfaces, but they don't have to be. Sure. They could just be concrete types. But it should be clear that when you new this thing up, it needs these things in order to do what it does. And if you instantiate a class and you try and call a method and it blows up and says, I couldn't find this database, or the such and such file wasn't found, and you have to go hunt through the code to find, oh, wait, no, it actually calls this method that does this other thing that needs that thing, that's time consuming. It's wasteful. And that class is lying to you, because it's telling you dishonestly that, hey, you can just new me up and I'll do my job. Whereas it should be honest and say, if you're going to instantiate me, you need to give me these things that I need to do my job.
That's a really interesting way of looking at it. Like the class, the whole, the class is lying to me is pretty explicit in the sense that you want a class to completely encapsulate the functionality that it's doing.
Right.
And if it needs something, it needs to ask for it.
Right. And that works with the strategy design pattern. I mean, that's basically how the strategy design pattern works, which is also what dependency injection is. Yeah. It's basically injecting these dependencies into that class once it's asked for them and said, I need these things.
That's awesome. So what other advice do you have for people that are looking to make their code more testable? And then a follow-up question to that, once you've told us that, is how much is too much when it comes to code coverage?
So making your code testable is all about breaking dependencies, making it so you can pass in the things that it needs. And also, the smaller your classes are, generally, the easier they are to test.
Sure.
So if you're following the SOLID principles, the S is single responsibility principle, mm-hmm. if your class only does one thing, it's much easier to reason about what it should do, how to write tests for that. And also, the classes tend to be small. And if they have dependencies, which most classes have some kind of dependency, there's not too many of them. Because mm-hmm. it only needs to do one thing. It only probably depends on one or two other things. And so by following that principle, you end up with generally smaller classes that are easier to test
right.
and easier to break the few dependencies they might have.
So the second question then becomes, okay, I know, like for me, like I didn't do tests for a while, and then I started doing tests, and I found that it was like a really good security blanket for when I had to make some big changes, right? If I had to change a test, that means that my API is broken or different.
Right.
But the question is, do I need 100% code coverage? Or is there a number where you could start to feel comfortable? Or is there not a number? Does it depend on the implementation of the thing?
I actually don't think there's a number. I mean, you can argue that more is better, but you shouldn't have a target like 100%, because then your developers are going to have to spend time when they could be delivering value doing stupid things like making sure there's a test for every single auto property that does a get set. Right? Like, you won't get 100% test coverage right. unless you test those things, but it's not adding any value. You can rely on the framework to do a get set right. property correctly. Now, what I would do is target where you want to have your test coverage and target the things that are most important to the business, and also the things that you've got heuristics telling you there's more likely to be bugs here. That could be a couple things. That could be the metrics we just talked about, like cyclomatic complexity. Mm-hmm. If it's got a cyclomatic complexity in the double digits, you better make sure you've got some tests on it. And if you only have, you know, one test for that method and it's got a cyclomatic complexity of 15, you need more, right?
Yeah.
You're not going to have 100% test coverage with that. But it's possible for you to have 100% test coverage and go through every if block, but still not cover every way that it could go through all the if blocks, right? So that cyclomatic complexity number almost tells you how many different tests you need to have at a minimum to cover every path through that method, which gets really difficult with any large number, obviously. So it's better to keep your method small so that that number doesn't get really large.
And then at that point, you're thinking, I should just rewrite the method.
Exactly. Or refactor it, extract some parts of it.
In your estimation, because you've obviously built a lot of software, I still build a lot of demoware, and I'll admit freely to that. What's a number that just you feel good about?
For test coverage?
Mm-hmm.
Well, for your core part of your application, you can get pretty close to 100%. Part of that is because I don't like a lot of get set properties, so most of the stuff that's there is logic. A number, I honestly don't even know. I don't even measure it. If I were going to guess, I would probably say 50%.
Yeah.
But it really matters if it's the right 50%.
Because
if your developers are gaming that number, if you're telling your developers, hey, you need to hit this number or else, or to get a bonus or whatever,
sure,
they're going to get that the easiest way they can. And the easiest way is going to be testing stuff that doesn't need tested because it doesn't have any way to fail, like properties, right?
So, I see.
So you don't want to encourage your developers to game the system, because what you're measuring is something they can easily do. There's a great Dilbert, I remember, where the boss says, hey, we're going to start paying you for every bug you fix. And Wally's like, great, I'm going to code myself up a new car. It's like, you just introduce bugs, fix them, introduce bugs, fix them. You know, it's like, you got to be careful what you measure and what's important.
So it feels like a lot of the stuff you've told us, just to start wrapping up, is it feels like you have to have that developer sixth sense to know about, you know, where I should refactor, how I should be testing things. Where can someone go to sort of learn more about how to get that sense?
Well, there's a few places. There's some great books. Clean Code by Uncle Bob Martin is an awesome book. I mentioned Refactoring, which is a good book to just learn more about how refactoring works. The Solid Principles are a great guide for how you want to kind of get your code toward. The thing to remember with those, and something I talk about in my conference talks, is follow something I call pain-driven development, which means until it's causing you some pain, don't try and fix it. You know, if you know the principles and you know what you would need to do to get things closer to them and better, then don't worry about trying to follow them all from day one.
Right.
Because you can't, right? Like the open-close principle is, you know, open to change, but it can't be open to change in every possible way. Mm-hmm. So you have to wait until you see what are the demands of the system, how is it needing to change, before you try and use that principle to fix that problem. The other thing is learn about code smells. If you know what these things are and they have a name, it's just like the principles, the design patterns, the code smells, they're named things that you can talk about. You can search for on Google, you can have a conversation on Twitter and say, you know, I'm seeing this code smell, what do people do to fix it? And once you know the names of these different smells, that helps a lot, because when you recognize it, you can put words to it and have a higher level conversation about it. And again, I've got a course on Pluralsight that talks about that. There's a great resource I put a lot of content into called deviq.com, mm-hmm, which talks about all these principles, anti-patterns, code smells. So you can check that out too.
That's awesome. So Dev Intersection, is this your first one? You've probably been to a lot of them.
I think this is my first Dev Intersection. I was always at Dev Connections for many years speaking. I haven't spoken in too recently. I was just at FalafelCon last 2 months ago, but my wife just had twins earlier this year, so I haven't been traveling too much for the last year and a half or so.
Business. So how do you think? What do you think about the Dev Intersection so far?
Oh, this has been an awesome show. I've loved the people, the size of it. It's got a great gang of speakers, most of whom I don't get to see very often, but I know a lot of them, and it's great to hang out. So I've been very pleased with this. I hope to get to come back here next year.
Awesome. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, bud.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks so much for watching. Again, we're in Las Vegas for Dev Intersection. We will see you next time. Take care.